doing news via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said diplomatic efforts were underway to save the remaining fighters holed up inside the Azovstal steelworks in the city of Mariupol as more civilians were evacuated from the bombed-out plant. The defenders have vowed not to surrender. Ukrainian officials fear Russian forces want to wipe them out by Monday in time for Moscow's commemorations of the former Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. The Taliban on Saturday ruled Afghan women must cover their faces according to a decree from the group's supreme leader. An escalation of growing restrictions on women in public that is drawing a backlash from the international community and many Afghans. A spokesman for the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice read the decree from the group's supreme leader at a press conference in Kabul, saying that a woman's father or closest male relative would be visited and eventually imprisoned or fired from government jobs if she did not cover her face outside the home. France's Emmanuel Macron was sworn in for his second term as president on Saturday, promising to lead the country with a new method as his political rivals kicked off campaigning for next month's legislative elections. In a country where presidents rarely get reelected, Macron won 58.5% of the votes in the second round against the far-right's Marine Le Pen, despite strong oppositions to his pro-business policies and a proposal to raise the retirement age. Relatives of the missing in Cuba's capital desperately searched Saturday for victims of an explosion at one of Havana's most luxurious hotels that killed at least 26 people, and rescuers used dogs to hunt for survivors at the hotel caused by a gas leak. VOA News. North Korea fired a ballistic missile from a submarine on Saturday, South Korea said. An escalation just before the inauguration of a South Korean president who has vowed to take a hard line against the North. South Korean military said North Korea fired what is believed to be a submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM, into the sea off its east coast around 5 o'clock GMT on Saturday from near Simpo, where North Korea keeps submarines as well as equipment for test firing. China's capital Beijing kicked off a fresh round of testing for COVID-19 on Saturday and shut more bus routes and metro stations as it seeks to avert the fate of Shanghai, where millions of residents have been locked down for over a month. The movement curbs on Shanghai, an economic and financial hub, have caused frustration among its 25 million residents and triggered rare protests over issues such as access to food and medical care, loss of income, and crowded as well as unsanitary conditions at central quarantine centers. Philippines presidential candidates were geared up for final rallies on Saturday to galvanize support and win over undecided voters 2 days before an election plagued by misinformation campaigns. Up to 65 million Filipinos are eligible to cast ballots on Monday to decide on the successor to President Rodrigo Duterte after his 6 years in power, plus thousands of other posts from lawmakers and governors to city mayors and councilors. India's Tata Steel said three contract workers had been injured in a blast at one of its plant units in the eastern state of Jharkhand on Saturday. The unit was not operational and was undergoing a dismantling process, Tata said in a statement. Tata is India's largest steelmaker by revenue. The company added that production has not been impacted. Berlin criminal investigators and prosecutors were on Saturday studying a device found and destroyed at a residential building housing Russian news agency staff in the city's Steglitz district, police said. The device was found on Friday, and investigators are looking into how dangerous it had been and who it was aimed at. That's what a Berlin police spokesman said in response to an inquiry. For more on this and all the other stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. We also have an app that you can download. Just search for VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We are working with the various partners and donors who are also helping us with the capacity building, for example, for the new procurement kit, and also coming up with new e-health systems that can also do tracking of drugs and the like.
Zambia lifts COVID restrictions but urges citizens to be vigilant, practice masking and frequent hand washing. We'll speak with the health minister.
The next line of action is for us to start up appeal arguments, substantive arguments before the Court of Appeal. And we have already filed those. We have also filed the synopsis of our arguments. It will be for the Court of Appeal to hear us orally on our arguments.
Lawyers for Enesbai Koroma, former Sierra Leonean president, deny shielding him from prosecution over allegations of crimes.
Even animals have rights we need to respect. So the way people behave, killing people because they are in power, it will give also a lesson to those that doing it, we can go after you.
And Guinea's opposition Liberal Bloc Party welcomes moves by authorities to prosecute former President Alpha Condé and his close associates. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambia's health minister recently lifted COVID-19 restrictions after transmission of the disease sharply fell. Sylvia Masebo says casinos, bars, churches, restaurants and markets are now allowed to fully operate. They will no longer need a permit to carry out their activities. Meanwhile, fully vaccinated travelers are no longer required to show proof of negative COVID test results. They are, however, required to show proof of being fully vaccinated. For more on the reasons behind the lifting of the restrictions, I reached Zambia's Health Minister, Sylvia Masebo. In the first part of this interview, Masebo underscored the need to ensure transparency in the procurement process at the ministry.
Improving Zambia's access to healthcare was one of our key promises prior to the elections in 2021, and it forms the backdrop of our manifesto in as far as healthcare is concerned. And since taking office, we are proud to be delivering on that promise. In the first instance, the issue of financing healthcare was cardinal, and so far, I can safely say we have done justice to the issue of financing. Our current budget for this year, 2022, was improved upon almost by over 44%. And relating to the financial part of it, we have also made sure that areas that were cardinal, for example, the issue of drug supply, the issue of equipment, those were issues that required enough resources. And I'm also happy to say that the government did increase the drug budget by almost 100%.
Your government has recently reviewed or dropped most COVID-19 regulations. There will be no PCR tests for persons traveling to Zambia who are vaccinated. Gatherings no longer need ministry. My question is, what informed these decisions?
We have been trying to balance between protecting the lives of the people and also looking at economic issues, also which also affects the livelihoods of the people. And in that regard, we did, yes, lift some of the measures that we had put in place. But this does not mean that we are saying that COVID is finished or COVID is normal. It is simply that we have to balance these two issues. But even as we have done that, we have continued to ensure that we encourage our people, one, to get vaccinated. We are trying very hard to push up the numbers of vaccination. You will appreciate that at the time when we took office, which was August, September, when I was appointed, we found that the total number of people that were vaccinated was only at 3.7. 3 months down the lane, we moved that up to almost 3 times 9%. Currently, as I speak now, 6 months down the line, in fact, I can start to say we are 22% currently as I speak now. In addition, we have made sure that the people continue to observe the 5 golden rules, the issue of masking up, avoiding crowded places, even as we no longer give those permits that we're giving before, but we discourage the public from spending a lot of time and hours in crowded places.
Now, so what changes has your ministry, the Ministry of Health, made or is making to plug the alleged holes in the ministry's procurement process, which, as you know, were well documented in the Auditor General's report the last few years?
As you'll appreciate, we were voted on the principle of zero tolerance to corruption. First of all, procurement was moved from the Ministry of Health and taken to a specialized institution, that is a procurement institution that we call ZAMSA. And so the issue of procuring big, contracts for drugs and the like is no longer in this ministry. And so we've created this institution, which we're capacitating, and we're building a new procurement committee a new procurement department within that new institution of men and women of a high integrity, people that share our principles, our values. And also the drug fund is going to be managed by the same procurement institution. The type of contracts that we're entering into for procurement of drugs is one which is long-term. We're calling these contract frameworks. These are for long-term, predictable, so that you don't find yourselves in what our colleagues were finding themselves in the previous administration, where they're buying drugs from streets, from companies that, were not even known in some case. We are working with the various partners and donors who are also helping us with capacity building, for example, for the new procurement, and also coming up with new e-health systems that can also do tracking of drugs and the like. So these are some of the measures we're taking. But also some of the cases have been taken to court, and there are a number of people that are appearing in the courts of law over some of the, the dealings of the past.
Sylvia Masebo is Zambia's health minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Sierra Leone, lawyers for former President Ernest Bai Koroma deny they are shielding him from prosecution over alleged crimes committed while he was leader of the West African country. The lawyers contend that an executive decision made by the former president should not be subject to litigation. Their remarks come after an appeals court ruled this week that Koroma will not have immunity over alleged crimes committed during his presidency. Critics say he wasted the court's time knowing that the constitution will not shield him or his associates from alleged crimes committed during his reign. For more reaction to the court ruling, I reach attorney Joseph Fitzgerald Kamara. He leads the defense team of lawyers for the former president.
The ruling is that we raised a question for reference to the Supreme Court from the Court of Appeal that the provisions of the Constitution vis-à-vis immunity of a former president mandates a reference and interpretation by the Supreme Court. And the Court of Appeal ruled today that the section, section 48, subsection 4 of the Constitution, is clear and does not need a case reference. The argument we have in mind is that from the facts, the former president decided at a meeting that the NASIT, that is the National Trust on Social Security, should move expeditiously and build a market for the local women. And the Commission of Inquiry found that the president, former president, uses executive power unduly. So that is that exercise of discretion that we queried that cannot be a subject of litigation. That a sitting president in exercising his discretion administratively cannot be a subject of litigation, even after he has left office. We have not gone to the substantive issues of yet. We will be arguing that when the court resumes. But for today, the argument was whether we can go to the Supreme Court for an interpretation of Section 48(4) of the Constitution, which deals on immunity of a former head of state.
Mr. Fitzgerald, what does this mean to the legal team representing the former president?
Well, it means that the Court of Appeal is now prepared to hear us fully on the substantive argument. And part of our arguments has always been that an executive president has the exercise of a discretion in the performance of his functions. And if even he has left the office, if those functions are administrative in nature and do not border on crime, the exercise of that discretion and immunity continues with him outside of the office. We will be raising that argument again, and we are ready to pursue the defense of His Excellency the President, Dr. Anasbai Kuma, anytime before any court of law. And that is where we are now, to start the case exhaustively.
Does that mean that the defense team for which you lead will be considering the ruling and decide the next step forward based on what the ruling of the appeals court is?
Oh, yes, certainly. We are reviewing and studying the ruling today because it's delivered by 3 judges. And after we are satisfied that we may want to continue as the case is, or we continue an appeal direct to the Supreme Court, a decision will be made before the end of the day.
But what do you tell the critics of the former president who said that a lot of wrongs happened or illegality happened under his administration and Assad should not be granted that immunity from prosecution and that everybody is equal before the law in Sierra Leone, so he should not be let go for alleged crimes he might have committed while in office?
Yeah, I can only say that the president's defense team is not arguing that he's above the law. No, that is not what he's saying. That if you want to bring a former president to be subjected to the jurisdiction of the courts, there are procedures that you can follow. And it is those procedures that haven't been followed. And in the particular instance which we raised, it's not an issue about corruption. It's about an administrative function for which he, as a president, has a duty and a responsibility to govern the state. And he exercised it judiciously. So that is the question before us. On the other matters to which his critics will be saying, those are matters for which he should not go freely. We are not there yet. We can only say that he's ready to defend every and single action that is taken while in office.
So how is the former president taking this ruling today?
Well, we haven't spoken to him as yet. He was busy in a meeting, and we believe that but he has absolute confidence in the leadership and team of his defense, and we will be advising him on the necessary next steps after we have digested the judgment and advise ourselves accordingly as to whether we will appeal or not.
Mr. Fitzgerald, from what you have seen today, what's the next line of action for you as the lead counsel of his defense team?
Well, the next line of action is for us to start up appeal arguments, substantive arguments before the Court of Appeal. And we have already filed those. We have also filed the synopsis of our argument. It will be for the Court of Appeal to hear us orally on our arguments.
Attorney Joseph Fitzgerald Kamara leads the defense team of lawyers for former Sierra Leone President Anasbai Kuma. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In Guinea, the opposition Liberal Bloc Party says it welcomes move by authorities to prosecute deposed President Alpha Condé and his close associates. The former president was toppled by the military led by Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya. Condé faces charges including murder, torture, kidnapping, disappearance, rape, sexual abuse and corruption. 26 close allies and associates of the former president faced similar charges, but supporters of the former president say the charges appear to be politically motivated to demonize the former president. They say it's also meant to prevent any of his close associates from seeking political office, including the presidency. Faya Milimono is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party. He tells me that he supports plans to prosecute the former president and his allies over the alleged crimes to prevent future wrongdoing in the West African country.
Our position is simple. We think that in any society, justice has to be implemented. when somebody lost his life, when somebody lost everything that he has as goods because of the action taken by somebody else, just because that person is in the position of doing it, even if he does it not according to the law, justice needs to be implemented. So basically, that is what has started. The all will be here by the justice system, and to establish whether or no they are guilty of anything.
But some of his supporters are saying this is persecution, which will create further divisions in Guinea. How do you respond to that?
On our side, the only thing that we won't accept is when somebody is condemned for what he has not done. Justice is not supposed to be against anybody.
How confident are you that the authorities will stick to the law, because the Constitution has been suspended anyway?
Yeah, the Constitution has been suspended, but that doesn't mean that the country is not under any law. Personally, I am in politics because I believe in parenting. I believe in justice. In any society, if you cannot dream of having peace if there is no justice. In many of our countries in Africa, when you look at the way people are acting toward other people, is unbelievable. So justice needs to be implemented. And that in that process, we have to make sure nobody is condemned for what he has not done.
But Fire, some people are suggesting that if this plan to prosecute the former president and his close aides and all former ministers goes ahead as planned, then it sends a bad signal to those who are currently in top leadership positions in Africa to leave.
That is exactly what Alpha Conde tried to do. And that is what the two first presidents of Guinea have done. The first one stayed in power until he died, 26 years he was the president. The second, 24 years he was the president. But the society is changing. Africa is no longer in the 50s or in the 60s. Today, things that were possible about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, are not going to be possible now. That's why when Alpha Conde and his regime tried to change the constitution to have a third term, and we know that if he was allowed to do so, he would pick a fourth term. That way, he would stay in power until he died. That didn't happen. You know, the army took over, and it gave lessons to anybody who want to do that in the future. Implementing justice will give also a lesson to whoever is in power. The other people are not like animals that you can. Even animals have rights. We need to respect. So the way people behave, killing people because they are in power, it will give also a lesson to those that doing it, we can go after you.
Faya Milimono is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Uganda, civil society and opposition groups are calling on General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, the son of President Yoweri Museveni, to quit the army if he wishes to seek political office. They contend that it is illegal for General Kainerugaba, the commander of the land forces of the Uganda People's Defense Force, to engage in politics. Their remarks follow recent tweets from Kainerugaba, where he asked Ugandans to vote whether they want him to run for office. Local media reports say only about 25% of the respondents urged him to run. For analysis and the latest developments, I read Sarah Biriti. She is the Executive Director at the Center for Constitutional Governance in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Our constitution is very clear on requiring officers serving in the forces, in the security forces, to be non-partisan and not to engage in politicking. The UPDF Act and the Political Parties and Organizations Act reinforce the provisions of the Constitution by clearly prohibiting serving officers in the UPDF from engaging in politicking and partisan campaigning, and the Political Parties and Organizations Act provides for punishment for that offense. So it's very unfortunate that the president is watching on as his son engages in impunity of the highest order and abuse of office of the Uganda People's Defense Forces by campaigning. If he wants to engage in politics, he should first resign from the army. And Ugandans who voted against that question rightly voted so.
Basera, the UPDF spokesperson, says that some of the tweets which Ugandans see as controversial are just the opinions of General Kanyarugaba. Your thoughts about that?
You know, that's condoning impunity. Let me give an example of General Tumukunde when he was an army representative in parliament. As a member of parliament, he was free to debate political issues. But when he voiced his opposition against the lifting of term limits, he was court-martialed for 9 years by the same UPDF for having engaged in a controversial political debate at a time. So for the spokesperson of the UPDF to respond that that's an opinion is double standards and abuse of the Constitution of Uganda and should be condemned.
But Sarah, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the recent 48th birthday bash of General Kanyarugaba is a way of the president to gradually introduce his son as a would-be successor? The party was attended by high government officials, including the president and Rwandan President Paul Kagame, which some people said looks or appears to be an anointing of Muhoozi Kanyarugaba as the possible successor of President Yoweri Museveni. What are your thoughts about it?
It's true that this is a project. He should know that there is no merit in launching such a plan, standing on the grounds of impunity and abuse of the Constitution of Uganda.
Masera, some people are suggesting that Muhoozi Kanyarugaba is a Ugandan and is qualified per the Constitution to stand as a candidate if he so wishes and gets out of the military and seeks political power. What is wrong with it? His supporters are asking.
First things first, let him get out of the army. He's taking advantage of a public office. He was everywhere donning a military uniform. That changes power relations with the citizens. Let him get out of the army. Let him get out of the citizen's uniform and join the political trenches like any other aspiring candidate.
His supporters are saying those who are criticizing his political ambitions are just jealous and appear not to be able to stand him because his father has been the president for a long time. Is that the reason some of you civil society organizations are criticizing him?
Well, there are two things. One is that we have laws in this country. I know that his father is not a good example in following laws. Let's follow the law. They say all men are equal before the law. If they are popular, why are they scared of observing the laws of the land?
Sarah Biriti is the Executive Director at the Center for Constitutional Governance. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. We'll be right back. are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, Buffers. Kenya has been hailed for passing a law giving the 500,000 refugees living in the country better access to education and employment. While some refugees in Kenya are reaping the benefits of the 2021 law, many face challenges that include the government's plan to shut down refugee camps by the end of June. For VOA, Juma Majanga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Ajak Jokajak is perusing textiles on a rainy afternoon in Nairobi. The 28-year-old South Sudanese refugee who grew up at the Kakuma refugee camp in northern Kenya never dreamed he would work one day as an intern at a major law firm. The law school graduate says, thanks to Kenya's Refugee Act, getting a job is much easier than it used to be.
You had to obtain a research permit before you start research. You had to obtain an internship permit before you start your internship. All those things now, it means you will not need another additional procedure, but just only your qualifications.
The Refugee Act was signed into law last year and went into effect in February. Some 500,000 refugees who live in Kenya stand to benefit from the measure. Jamin Kuswania is a project manager at the International Rescue Committee in Nairobi.
Biggest problem that refugees have had in this country since 1991 have actually been the encampment policy, where refugees are domiciled to live within particular camps. And what we see in the Refugee Act of 2021 is that it moves towards removing that aspect of encampment.
Implementation of the Refugee Act has been slow. Speaking to VOA, Stanley Mwango from the Department of Refugee Services notes that Parliament has not passed the regulation framework for the new law. The new law is part of the Kenyan government's refugee integration program. Refugee camps currently house more than 400,000 people, mostly from South Sudan and Somalia. Kenya's government has said it will shut down the camps at the end of June and previously cited security reasons. So far, there have been no evictions, and relatively few people have left the sites voluntarily. For most of the refugees, home is the Dadaab camp bordering Somalia, or Kakuma, which borders South Sudan. Kenya has one of Africa's largest refugee populations. Aid agencies say more work needs to be done. Here again is Jamin Kuswania.
The government will need to relook at the timelines that are actually in place, but also take cognizance of now the Refugee Act of 2021 and begin a rethink in terms of how then do we need to handle refugees in the country, how do we need them to transition refugees from the camps. Because it needs to be a roadmap towards solutions.
For Ajak, the new law couldn't have come at a better time. After being held back because of his refugee status, the new law has allowed him to apply for admission as a lawyer at the High Court of Kenya and a job promotion.
It has enabled the refugees to actually access certain services without them being restricted. And that is why, you see, some of us are very hopeful.
Ajak has also left the camps and now lives in Nairobi. If the Refugee Act is put into action, more refugees like him may see their futures become brighter. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN's World Food Programme says 6 million Somalis are facing food insecurity from a record drought that has sent nearly 800,000 people into camps. Aid groups say mobile cash transfers have become essential for getting quick help to people in Somalia's remote, drought-affected and unsafe areas. For VOA, Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
The severe drought ravaging parts of Somalia has forced hundreds of families to flee their homes for refugee camps like one on the outskirts of Mogadishu. Asiya Mukhtar Hassan, a mother of six and recent arrival to the camp, left her home in the remote Shabelle region where aid agencies face difficulties delivering assistance. Hassan and a majority of the camp's residents received cash assistance through their mobile phones while still living in villages. Aid agencies sent help through mobile money transfers, view it as a safe, effective way to reach drought victims. For Hassan and her family, life was unbearable as food and water became scarce even with the aid. Using the money sent to her mobile phone, Hassan paid her way to Mogadishu with her family. Asiya says that a severe drought, water crisis, extreme heat, and lack of food forced them to flee from their homes. She says money sent by mobile phones enabled them to come here, but it was too little to meet their needs. She says they are suffering, dear brothers and sisters. She repeats they were only able to come here because of the money sent to them by their mobile phones. An elderly refugee at the camp arrived with her special needs daughter and seven other children from the Dinsor district. She says the mobile money assistance saved her family. She says their fields went dry and their crops and livestock died. There was no water and no food. They were helpless, and that none of them had any hope left until their brothers came to their aid and they transferred money. She says that this made it possible for them to escape the drought and come here. Among the aid agencies helping displaced families is the Norwegian Refugee Council. The agency has sent mobile money transfers to about 65,000 people, money in hard-to-reach locations. Abdullahi Mahmoud Abdullah is the agency's livelihood and food security coordinator. He says the mobile money transfer program makes it easier to reach those in need. Abdullahi says the use of mobile money transfers has helped a lot for families affected by drought. He says they disperse money to their mobile phone numbers in order for these vulnerable families to buy food, water, and other essential items. Somalia's population is predominantly nomadic. Livestock trade is the main source of income. As long as the country remains vulnerable to droughts and poor infrastructure, mobile money transfers provide a convenient way to help families struggling in remote areas. Mohamed Shahnoor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
With me.
That was Music from the Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, those who laugh at others' mistakes often make the same mistakes themselves. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.